Hello friends, we are now continuing with the Rays and Initiations webinar commentaries. We're in program number 25. This is in the second part of the book following the exposition on the 14 advanced rules. Commentaries on that exist in written form, although I would like to perhaps have a chance to discuss them more informally in this manner. We are about to begin a very important section, one of the most advanced teachings on meditation given in the Tibetan's work is the meditation on the Antikarana. And here we have about 89 or 90 pages where we are developing the science of the Antikarana. A lot of work has been done on this by many students, but perhaps we'll be able to say something which will be of value as we go along through this important section. There are really, in the second part of the book here, some very important sections on the Antikarana and on initiation in general and on some of the work that must be accomplished within the ashram and by those who are approaching the ashram. So anyway, here we go, the science of the Antikarana. We remember perhaps from Esoteric Psychology 2, after the technique of fusion was discussed and three meditative formulas were given regarding that technique of fusion, namely isolated unity, inclusive reason, and presented attributes, a certain technique of duality was hinted at. That was earlier in the process and quite a bit before this section of the work was written. And now we're dealing with the dual life of discipleship and the dual life of the initiate, even the dual life of the master. This idea of dual life is working all through this section, and I think that as the science of the Antikarana is in a way very much about promoting that dual life on a number of different levels. So, as we enter on the consideration of the dual life of the initiatory process, two poles being found and an anchor, let us say, within the spiritual triad or for the master within the monad, and also an anchor within the soul-infused personality. As we enter on the consideration of the dual life of the initiatory process, I would call your attention to the wording used, and particularly to its significance in reference to the initiatory process. I think he's going to tell us it's not about a particular event that occurs at a particular momentous time. It's more about a process of unfoldment and stabilizing those unfoldments and having those unfoldments at last confirmed by a higher power which gives them a kind of stability and perpetuity not achievable by the human being. So the initiatory process, this deals, as we shall see, not with the effort of the disciple to live simultaneously the life of the spiritual world and the practical life of the physical plane service. I mean, that is important, of course, but entirely with the preparation of the disciple for initiation, and therefore with his mental life and attitudes. That's a big hint, isn't it? That it is, well, let's see, what do we have here? Whoops, we have nothing. All right, I want to get my, there we go. His mental life and attitudes, okay. So, the real preparation for initiation concerns the mental life and attitudes of the would-be initiate, and not so much living the outer plane life. It is the state of the consciousness of the would-be initiate which is of moment, and that's a very subtle thing and not necessarily easily apprised or appreciated. This statement might be regarded as concerning itself primarily with two major aspects of his mental life, and not with the life of relation between soul and personality. We seem to be moving beyond this preliminary type of relationship, which is very important to cultivate, and which every neophyte in the work of spiritual occultism must cultivate. We're going into something a little different. It is proper, consequently, to see a duality existing in the consciousness of the disciple, and both of its aspects existing side by side. A duality existing in the consciousness of the disciple. We're not so much talking about activity upon the outer plane, as important as that may be. So we have number one, the life of awareness, in which he expresses the soul attitude, soul awareness, and soul consciousness through the medium of the personality upon the physical plane. This he learns to register and express consciously. So we have a conscious soul expression. And number two, the intensely private and purely subjective life in which he, the soul-infused personality, oriented upon the mental plane, brings certain things into increasing rapport. So, you know, when we look at point number one, we could think that that was subjective, but something else is still more subjective. So he's bringing intensely private, I guess he's giving us an injunction against sharing too much about it. And when he talks about subjectivity, he's not just talking about the consciousness within the subtle bodies, the astral and mental body. He's talking about something deeper within the energy system. So the intensely private and purely subjective life in which he, the soul-infused personality, oriented upon the mental plane, I guess he's, by this time, he really is achieving this mental polarization, brings into increasing rapport, A, his lower concrete mind and the higher abstract mind. When they're brought into rapport with each other, you know, they form a kind of a unified field, and the lines of demarcation between the two are not so strict. There is a fluidity between them. B, himself and the master of his ray group, thus developing the ashramic consciousness. And this is interesting. This is not just the master of his particular ashram, but of his entire ray group. And let us say, with the great second ray ashram, that would be Master K.H. Himself and the hierarchy as a whole, becoming increasingly aware of the spiritual synthesis underlying the united ashrams. And this is a synthesis in energy and a synthesis in consciousness. He thus consciously and steadily approaches the radiant center of the solar ashram. That is the great ashram we call the hierarchy, as it represents some aspect of our solar logos, the Christ himself, the first initiator. So we can see that that somehow the first aspect here, the first aspect is somewhat more individual. A soul attitude, soul awareness, soul consciousness expressed through the personality. And I think the word express is very important, or expresses, because this is all about making soul attitudes manifest. But now there's a great interiority involved with the second of these aspects here. Discuss the intensely private and purely subjective life. In other words, it will have an effect upon expression, but this is not, strictly speaking, about expression, in which he, the soul-infused personality, soul-infused already through aspect number one, oriented upon the mental plane from which it is possible to touch various phases of the higher life, brings into rapport increasingly, his lower concrete mind and the abstract mind. So, you know, this is a mercurial attitude, a mercurial Venusian attitude, bringing different fields into rapport. And himself, supposedly the soul-infused personality, inspired even from the triad, himself coming on rapport with the master or monadic center of his ray group, and thus developing the ashramic consciousness, not just of his subsidiary ashram, but of his entire ray ashram, developing the relationship with his entire ray ashram, and not just with his particular subsidiary ashram, although that occurs on the way and is important, and himself with the hierarchy as the whole, becoming increasingly aware of the spiritual synthesis underlying the united ashram. So we look at it as one vehicle of Sanat Kumara, and we do not always emphasize the distinctions, or let us call them the ray distinctions. He thus consciously and steadily approaches the radiant center of the solar ashram. It's rarely discussed that way, calling the hierarchy of the solar ashram the Christ himself, the first initiator. Of course, he will have, to a degree, already met the Christ by the time of this type of development. He will have met the Christ in one or both of the preliminary initiations. So the inner life, with its three slowly revealed objectives, concerns essentially the life of preparation for initiation. And this is the inner life, the intensely private, purely subjective life, bringing his usual personality mind on rapport with the higher abstract mind, coming on rapport with the master of his ray group, and coming on rapport with the hierarchy in the center of the hierarchy itself. So the three above approaches, or reconciliations, maybe that's not even the word, the three above induced relationships have to do with preparation for initiation. There is no, see, it's so interesting, you know, excuse me, we're beginning to talk about the Antikarana, and immediately he is very deeply into the subject of initiation, because we can see that the development of the Antikarana is one of the aspects which leads to the possibility of initiation, true initiation. I suppose it was a time when the method of developing the Antikarana was not widely known, and there were still initiates, but this of the probationary type. But this facilitates their development, and certainly, as we learned, I think, in the earlier program, that when a person is an initiate of the third degree, it indicates that the rapport between the mental unit and the monastic permanent atom has been completely established. So that is the very first phase of the type of Antikarana which the Tibetan is teaching us how to build. And it really does represent the completion of a certain important unit of work. There is no initiation for the disciple until he has begun consciously to build the Antikarana, and thus bring the spiritual triad and the mind as the highest aspect in the three worlds into a close relationship. And by this, I think he means true initiation, the third degree, because there's so much Antikarana building going on around the second degree, at least in current occult instruction, and not much at all around the time of the first degree. It's too early. The task there is to bring the personality en rapport with the soul and induce a certain measure of soul infusion before the kind of antikarana building that goes on around the second degree can really occur. And this will lead to true initiation. Later, he brings his physical brain into a position of a recording agent on the physical plane, thus again demonstrating a clear alignment and a direct channel with the spiritual triad, straight through to the brain via the antikarana, which has linked the higher mind and the lower. So we see that the antikarana also has a direct link, eventually, with the physical brain. Okay, he brings his physical brain into a position of a recording agent upon the physical plane. We've discussed this very much in our last program, how the right kind of alignment induces accurate registration of that which occurs upon the higher planes within the physical brain, and how this is one of the major tests for initiation, to bring these higher contacts through with accuracy. So there is no initiation for the disciple. He's already a disciple, meaning that he has taken the first degree. All true aspirants are initiates of the first degree. And you are an aspirant until you have taken the third initiation. So there is no initiation for the disciple until he has begun consciously to build the antikarana. And, well, we can do that now. I think we probably had other methods of building it, more from within the causal body itself in the older days, before a method such as the Tibetan has presented was widely given to those who were ready for it. So could there have been the conscious building of the antikarana before the Tibetan gave us the particular method that he's going to discuss here? I would say, yes, there could be, but it would have been more individual and less of a specific technique which could be mastered by many. There is no initiation for the disciple until he has begun consciously to build the antikarana. And so we understand that in our approach to the possibility of initiation, which is the prerogative, even the necessity for all true disciples, the building of the antikarana is a paramount task. And when this antikarana is really built, not just the earlier phases of it, the spiritual triad, at least in its aspect of the abstract mind, the spiritual triad and the mind, the concrete mind is the highest aspect in the three worlds, will be brought into a close relationship. And this is a very important Mercurian, I would say, type of task. Then we can gain in our mind and brain a true registration of the perspective, the impersonal perspective of the spiritual triad. So we have soul, mind, brain, but really the true soul is the triad. What we have is triad, concrete mind, and eventually brain when it's brought into the right position and susceptibility as a recording agent upon the physical plane. Okay, so this is not easily accomplished, we see. This involves much work, much interpretive capacity, and that again, you know, the planet of interpretation is Mercury. Really, the planet involved in the building of the antikarana is particularly Mercury, so it's interesting that this very Mercurian Master DK would be the one presenting us with the science of the antikarana, a very Mercurian ability, and much power to visualize. Well, work we often associate with the physical plane, visualization with the astral plane, interpretive capacity with the mental plane. He says, I'm choosing my words with care. So when he does that, you know, it's always best to ponder. We are going to have new experiences here, and we have to know what they mean, hence the interpretive capacity, the constant meditative attempts to achieve this, and the ability to visualize the rainbow bridge, or at least a dual-colored bridge consisting of the colors of the soul ray and the personality ray. This visualization is not necessarily concerned with form and with concrete mental presentations. It is concerned with the pictorial and symbolic sensitivity which expresses interpretively the spiritual understanding conveyed by the awakening intuition, the agent of the spiritual triad. Here, well, this is really an important statement and maybe a little difficult to interpret, but it's not usually the visualization of concrete things. Pictorial and symbolic sensitivity, so what we visualize will be in pictures and symbols, but it will somehow express our spiritual understanding, which the intuition conveys. In the Antikarana process, when we're engaging in visualization, we attempt somehow to link with the intuition, with the Buddhic plane. The work of visualization is largely carried on in relation to the astral plane, but using the mind, lower mind as well. And the astral and the Buddhic plane are en rapport. So here the intuition is the agent of the spiritual triad conveying the energy which is coming from the spiritual triad and helping to appear certain pictures, certain symbols which represent that energy. So we're not dealing with concrete visualization per se. I think we should put that down. Not dealing with visualization of concrete objects or things per se. Maybe it's a more fluid type of visualization involving energy streams and colors and sensed radiation, visualized radiation, and so forth. So if we are sensitive to the intuition, there will be a pictorial and symbolic sensitivity which arises in response to the touch of intuition. So arising as a response to the touch of intuition. T-U-C-H, touch. Yeah. Which expresses interpretively the spiritual understanding. So what appears as picture and symbol has meaning. And maybe according to the depth of our spiritual understanding, due to our contact with the intuition, so will be the nature of the kinds of pictorial or symbolic images that appear. So the awakening intuition is not awakened yet. It won't really be fully awakened until the fourth degree, but it is awakening. Okay, so he's giving us a special meaning of the kind of visualization in which we are to engage and talking about its connection with the intuition and how what appears through this pictorial and symbolic sensitivity is in a way induced by the intuition. The meaning of this becomes clearer as the work proceeds. So in other words, we have to do in order to know. So we have to do in order to know. It is difficult for the man who is beginning the work of constructing the Antikarana to grasp the meaning of visualization as it is seen to be related to a growing consciousness, a growing responsiveness to that which the ashramic group conveys to him, to his emerging vision of the divine plan as it exists in reality, and to that which is committed to him as the effect or the result of each successive initiation. Let's go over that again. It is difficult for the man who is beginning the work of constructing the Antikarana to grasp the meaning of this type of visualization, at least, as it is seen to be related to a growing responsiveness to that which the ashramic group conveys to him. This is outpictured in visualization. It is related to his emerging vision of the divine plan as it exists in reality. And it is related to that which is committed to him as the effect or result of each successive initiation. Okay, so in other words, visualization will represent these three factors. So it's a responsiveness to that which the ashramic group conveys, to emerging vision of the divine plan, and to that which is committed to him as a result of successive initiations. These factors may be represented in the type of visualization in which he engages, and with increasing ability for that which is visualized to represent these factors, what the ashram conveys, what the divine plan is, and what initiation has allowed him to touch. Okay, the effect or result of each successive initiation. I prefer the word effect to the word result, for the initiate increasingly works consciously with the law of cause and effect on planes other than the physical. All right, so the word effect relates us to this law of karma as it works out on planes other than the physical. We use the word result to express the consequences of that great cosmic law as they demonstrate in the three worlds of human evolution. This is the law of cause and effect, the law of karma. Okay, so, you know, when he really is careful in his choice of words, we want to try to follow his reasoning. Okay. Yes, you know, scanning here for things which can be further elaborated. Suffice it to say, visualization is a very important aspect in the building of the Antikarana. It is the second phase in this sixfold process, and it gives us the ability actually to touch and be touched by high levels of vibration, which have to make their way into the physical brain there to be registered. It is in connection with this effort that he discovers the value, uses, and purpose of the creative imagination. When we visualize, there is some guidance to it. It's not just active imagination where we let any image enter the mind whatsoever. It's a kind of a guided visualization. And it is creative in the sense that it is directed towards a representation of higher states of awareness. It helps to bring their creative effects down into the lower worlds. So the mind is involved in marshaling, supervising, directing the imagination when that imagination is creative imagination. It is meant to represent a certain plan, a certain goal, even a certain purpose. This creative imagination is all that remains to him eventually of the active and immensely powerful active astral life, which he has lived for so many lives. So while the astral body is going to be subdued and its glamorously attractive or repelling images will be quieted and even negated, there will be this power to conceive of form in a planned and purposeful manner. So the forms conceived do correlate with that which the spiritual triad indicates as related to the plan. So really, the intuition is the realm of pure reason, and eventually the creative imagination outpictures in symbol and pictorial representation that which embodies the realization of what the intuition conveys. So the creative imagination is all that remains to him eventually of the active and intensely powerful astral life which he has lived for so many lives As evolution proceeds, his astral body becomes a mechanism of transformation. Okay. Maybe we're talking about the period of the second initiation, desire being transformed into aspiration. There's no longer a lower or a horizontal magnetic outreach towards objects to which one is attracted, but there is an outreach towards goals and states which are higher in their nature, and so a more vertical reaching towards. His astral body becomes a mechanism of transformation, desire being transformed into aspiration, and that is very much done in the sign Taurus, and aspiration itself being transformed into a growing and effective, into a growing and expressive intuitive faculty. And here we have here the importance of the sign Sagittarius, which is a sign not only of aspiration, fiery aspiration, but is one of the intuitive signs. As DK tells us in esoteric astrology. So we are moving then from desire to aspiration to intuition, movement from desire to aspiration to intuition. Okay. This is deep material and very psychologically important and very important for understanding this higher type of meditative process. This creative imagination is all that remains to him eventually of the active and immensely powerful astral life which he has lived for so many lives. It's a way of bringing him en rapport with the intuition and hence with the spiritual triad and hence with the divine plan and hence with reality as it is and is purely and reasonably presented on the plane of intuition. As evolution proceeds, his astral body becomes a mechanism of transformation. Desire becomes uplifting. It's transformed into aspiration. There, the Taurus energy is involved. I think I should put that in. The highest form of aspirational idealism is achieved in Taurus. And aspiration itself becomes transformed into a growing, expressive, intuitive faculty. Interesting that these two signs are related. As we see, when we travel here to esoteric astrology, and we go to page 332, and we see that Taurus rushes blindly until Sagittarius directs. See, aspiration is there for Taurus. And then when we go to Sagittarius, there's a directing power as well. It is related to Pisces, but the two are related to targeting, we might say. The eye of the bull, the archer aims for the eye of the bull. So the two are very much related to vision and to illumination. The Buddhic faculty, I think we can relate to Taurus as well. It is a sign that brings in the fourth ray, which gives it an alliance with the fourth or intuitive plane. Sagittarius, interestingly, also brings in the fourth ray. Okay. So where is our astral body at this point? Is it the engaged in following desire in a customary manner? Is it related to aspiration, and are we uplifting the nature of our desires towards those less tangible objectives which will focus our consciousness on higher planes? Or are we allowing aspiration to become intuition? Now, that's also discussed in the Sagittarius chapter. We have here the arrow of aspiration returns as the arrow of intuition. So if we aspire keenly enough, you know, ask and it shall be answered, you know, knock and seek. Seek and you shall find, knock and it shall be opened to you. Ask and you will receive. So if we attempt to elevate our point of tension, an intuitive response is the result. But we have to keenly focus on that which we have not yet achieved, objectives of a higher nature, and forego our customary attractions to the factors which exist in the three lower worlds. This is what the Buddha, a great Taurus, would have us do. The reality of this process is demonstrated in the emergence of that basic quality which has always been inherent in desire itself. And that is the imaginative quality of the soul, implementing desire and steadily becoming a higher creative faculty as desire shifts into ever higher states and leads to ever higher realizations. So the imaginative quality of the soul, conveying to us the realization of the phenomena and energies of the higher worlds. So the reality of this process is demonstrated in the emergence of that basic quality, which has always been inherent in desire, imagination. And it is the imaginative quality of the soul which puts us en rapport with states which are outside the realm of the three lower worlds. And after all, these states are our objectives. The imaginative quality of the soul implementing desire, because when we imagine, we facilitate the accomplishment of desire, whatever its level may be. And this, our power to imagine, becomes higher and higher, a higher creative faculty, as desire shifts. We create on lower planes a replica of that which is found on higher planes. So, let me put it that way. We create on lower planes through imagination that which is found on higher planes, and so the archetype will be reflected in lower patterns. That's what we seek to do, to archetypalize our experience and align it with divine purpose. Okay. Well, it runs deep here, and we could ponder for a long time, and we have to, of course, experiment in our meditations with this. The imaginative quality of the soul implementing desire and steadily becoming a higher creative faculty as desire shifts into ever higher states and leads to higher realizations. What do we have to create? What is this faculty creating? What is this creative faculty creating? Representations in the lower worlds of the higher patterns, which are inherent in the divine plan. This faculty eventually invokes the energies of the mind, this outpicturing of that which we desire, and the mind plus the imagination becomes in time a great invocative and creative agent. Very important here. The mind plus the imagination becomes in time a great invocative and creative agent. We are reaching towards the appreciation, the registration of higher and higher states, and we use our mind-guided imagination to achieve them. We use our mind-guided creative imagination to achieve higher states towards which our spirit longs. It is thus that the spiritual triad is brought into rapport with the threefold personality, and basically what he's saying, through the use of the creative imagination guided by the mind. Note that he does not separate the imagination from the mind, and both must be used together in a way which compromises neither, but which in fact supports both. Each supports the other. So we have to develop a consecrated, plan-sensitive, creative imagination. We have to, under the guidance of intuition, we have to allow to be formed those images which will relate the higher and lower worlds, which will relate the patterns of the divine plan to the patterns in which we work in the lower three worlds. So we can ask ourselves, you know, each one of us, to what is our imagination consecrated? Is it consecrated? When we imagine, what do we imagine? Is it a mentally guided, a soul-infused mind guiding the out-picturing which the astral body can produce, or are we allowing lower promptings to bring forth certain images which have nothing to do with that which the plan, the divine plan, would see accomplished? So the consecrated creative imagination, the consecrated plan-sensitive creative imagination under the guidance of intuition, which is growing in power. I mean, how do we know what the plan is to be? Well, the intuition knows this with immediacy, and that intuition is within us, so something within us deeply knows what is required and can guide the whole creative process in the lower worlds. The intuition can guide the creative process in the lower worlds so that the mind-guided or mind-directed creative imagination is consecrated to picture the patterns which must emerge, and not just personal patterns prompted by desire, and not just personal patterns prompted by desire. I have told you in earlier writings that basically the astral plane, you know, always watch for the qualifiers. Astral matter, I guess, is not non-existent, but the astral plane as we usually conceive it is not a reality. It's just a fabrication which is eventually dissipated. I've told you in earlier writings that basically the astral plane is non-existent as a part of the divine plan. Okay. Well, it may exist in its sort of illusory actuality, but it does not represent the divine plan as that plan exists on the higher planes from the Atman plane on down. It is fundamentally the product of glamour, of kama manas, that is desire and mind mixed together in a way which serves neither, a glamour which humanity itself has created from early Atlantean days under the promptings of its own ambition and the misguidance of the Black Lodge seizing an opportunity to misdirect humanity. A glamour which humanity itself has created and which it has lived practically since early Atlantean days. And what are early Atlantean days? Once he gave us a kind of figure, early Atlantean, oh, that's at length, Atlantean days were 12 million years ago. Okay, the effect of an increasing soul contact has not simply been to dispel the mists of glamour. Sometimes soul contact can augment them, but it has also served to consolidate and bring into effective use, therefore, the imagination with its overwhelmingly powerful creative faculty. So the question is this dedicated to that which is plan aligned, or dedicated to the out picturing of the normal desire nature? Out picturing. Okay. So, the effect of an increasing soul contact has not simply been to dispel the mists of glamour. I suppose when soul contact is focused through the sharp, focused mind, it does help. So, when focused through the laser beam of mind, the soul influence can assist in the dispelling of glamour. But it has also served to consolidate and bring into effective use, therefore, the imagination with its overwhelmingly powerful creative faculty. I suppose this is for good or for ill. This creative energy of imagination, of out-picturing, of creating images and forms, creating images and pictorial forms, when implemented by an illumined mind, a soul-illumined mind, with its thought-form-making ability, is then wielded by the disciple in order to make contacts higher than with the soul and to bring into symbolic form that of which he becomes aware through the medium of a line of energy, the antikarana, which he is steadily scientifically creating. So this is put in very technical language. How do we know what is above? We touch it and a symbolic form may appear and embody that which we have touched. I mean, there are symbols which are empty of real higher contact, but there are contact, but there are those which really do embody the higher touch. So we are trying to emerge from this glamour, this camomanus, this creation of forms which have nothing to do with the expression of the divine plan, into the creation of forms through the use of the intuitively inspired, soul-inspired creative imagination. Forms which then will represent the divine plan. Because we're involved in a creative process here, we are out-picturing, and what we out-picture tends to happen in the lower three worlds. So we have to out-picture that which is really aligned with the intuition and with the higher aspects, the soul aspects, higher aspects of the mind. The effect of an increasing soul contact has not simply been to dispel the mists of glamour. Somewhere DK tells us, you know, it's really the sharp, focused, laser-like objective mind, albeit empowered by the soul, which is the reducer of glamour, and that soul energy itself, when the mind is not sufficiently involved, can, in fact, increase the glamour. It's intuition that dispels illusion, and the focused laser-like, accurate, objective mind, which dissipates glamour. But that is, a soul alignment is still connected to that use of laser-like mind. So, this soul contact, increasing soul contact, also has served to consolidate and bring into effective use the imagination with its overwhelmingly powerful creative faculty, because he has talked about, DK has talked about imagination as a soul faculty, and so it stimulates the reflected astral faculty of imagination, a creative faculty. So this creative energy, when implemented, I mean, when given over simply to desire, it's going to create glamour and all sorts of misapprehension on the astral plane. But when implemented by the illumined mind with its thought form making ability, and the thought form making ability will affect the images made, so the illumined mind will affect the images made. When implemented by the illumined mind with its thought form making ability, is then wielded by the disciple in order to make contacts higher than with the soul. So creative imagination brings us into contact with the spiritual triad, which is the reason why we, you know, envision the twofold rainbow bridge touching, at least symbolically, the realms of the spiritual triad. So it is a realm higher than that of the soul, which is found in the builder upon the second subplane of the mental plane. But the spiritual triad has its lowest point on the first subplane of the mental plane. So when it's wielded by the disciple, it makes contacts higher than that, than with the soul, and brings into symbolic form, and that's so important here, that of which he becomes aware through the medium of a line of energy, the antikarana, which he is steadily and scientifically creating. So he touches something, and how does he represent it to himself? He touches something high through the use of the creative imagination, and he represents it symbolically himself through forms which result from that contact. We have to, you know, assess our imaginative life, and we have to look at what may be the quality of the forms that appear to us in our creative imagination. What is the nature of those forms? Perhaps it will tell us what particular vibratory source is stimulating this out-picturing ability. I guess that's why alignment is so very important, to make sure that it is soul sources and triadal sources which are stimulating the creative imagination, and not the promptings of the lower body or the selfish mind, or, you know, any of those personal promptings, which can also induce a type of outpicturing which is related to these lower objectives. Okay. It might be said equally symbolically, that means not, you know, not literally, and yet conveying important information, that at each initiation he tests the connecting bridge. You know, what really does it touch? What realm does it touch? And discovers gradually the soundness of that which he has created. One wonders about sound in connection with the bridge. It's an interesting word. Soundness is interesting. It can hint at the participation of sound in the building and sustaining of the bridge. He discovers gradually the soundness of that, it usually means firmness, of that which he has created under the inspiration of the spiritual triad. You know, so perhaps let us say building of the antikarana is inspired from above, and only when that inspiration is present will the process be successful. It's not a question of someone below saying, well, really you should build your antikarana. It's a sense of the, it's a question of the sensed need inspired from above. So it might be said equally symbolically that at each initiation he tests the connecting bridge and discovers gradually the soundness of that which he has created under the inspiration of the spiritual triad. It's not some inert factor to be reached. It is actively engaged in evoking response from the lower man. Of that which is created under the inspiration of the spiritual triad, and with the aid of the three aspects of his mind, the abstract mind, the soul or son of mind, and the lower concrete mind, and these are one way of looking at the three minds, one way of looking at the three minds which must unite in the fifth ray formula, or word of power, and with the aid of the three aspects of his mind, combined with the intelligent cooperation of his soul-infused personality. Let's see if I can make a sentence out of that. He tests the connecting bridge and gradually discovers the soundness of that which he has created under the inspiration of the spiritual triad, and with the aid of the three aspects of his mind, combined with the intelligent cooperation of his soul-infused personality. In the early stages of this invocative work, he's calling upon for a response from the higher triadal sources. The instrument used is the creative imagination. So he's attempting, he's under the inspiration of the triad, but he's also attempting to invoke or see that there is evoked a response from the triad, and he uses the creative imagination to call for that response, to invoke that evocation. Okay, it might be said equally symbolically that at each initiation he tests the connecting bridge and discovers gradually the soundness of that which he has created under the inspiration of the spiritual triad. And he's created on the end with the aid. He's created it under the inspiration of the triad and with the aid of the three aspects of the mind. So the bridge is created through triadal inspiration and with the aid of the mind, three aspects of the mind. So the bridge is created from above and below. The abstract mind, the soul or son of mind, and the lower concrete mind, combined with the intelligent cooperation of the soul-infused personality. He's not simply a personality at this point. He cannot really begin to build the bridge until he is a soul-infused personality. This enables him at the very beginning to act as if he were capable of thus creating. Using the creative imagination, he acts as if. Then, when the as-if imaginative consciousness is no longer useful, he becomes consciously aware of that which he has, with hope and spiritual expectancy, sought to create. So he becomes aware of the Antikoron. He discovers this as an existent fact, and knows past all controversy that faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. And here he is quoting Saint Paul. And imagination yields, let's spell it right, yields to the realization of a created reality. The Antikorana. So we begin with creative imagination, and eventually we realize that in fact we have created this bridge of light which is going to connect the higher and lower worlds. Well, let me say then that this, oh, it's so deep, and it requires such consistent pondering. We really, in the schools of the future, we will pore over such information. So let me say then that this is the end of Raised and Initiation Webinar Commentary Program 25, and pages 441 to 444. And we will continue here with a new section, beginning of Ray's and Initiation Webinar Commentary, Program 26, pages 444 to something. And we're beginning a new section called Building the Antikarana. Well, it's so subtle that unless we really ponder over these words and find that internal response to our pondering, we may simply get caught in a kind of concrete consideration of what the Tibetan has presented to us, and that is not the way to go. We want to touch the implications of the subtler implications of what he is seeing. Anyway, we have established the importance of the creative imagination in the building process, and that creative imagination has to be guided by the soul of the human mind and eventually by the intuition itself, so that what the imagination produces is a true representation of that which the intuition reveals on its own plane, the Buddhic plane. Okay, friends, I think that will be it for the moment, and we'll see if I can get to this. I've gone over this many times. I've taught this to classes, and I've had to teach it to myself as well. It's deep, and only practice of that which the Tibetan has given will confirm the reality of that which he imparts. So we cannot grasp this simply theoretically. We must do in order to know. Okay, we'll move on to Program 26 as shortly as possible. See you then.